Film 4. Film 4 presents, in association with Northern Ireland Screen, the Broadcasting Commission of Ireland, and the Wales Creative IP Fund, a Blast Films production. Northern Ireland, 1981. 2,187 people have been killed in the Troubles since 1969. The British government has withdrawn the political status of all paramilitary prisoners. Irish Republicans in the Mays prison are on a blanket and no wash protest. A grey metal lid is banged repeatedly against concrete. A young woman, shaking with the repetitive movement, stares straight ahead intensely. Hunger. A clean white bathroom sink is filled with hot water. Two rings are placed next to the tap in front of a pink nail brush. A middle-aged man, Ray Lohan, lays both hands, which are scraped and bruised around the knuckles, into the water. His face is healthy but aging. He opens his blue eyes and stares hard into his reflection in a wall mirror. He looks away, pulls the plug, letting the water drain, and puts his rings back on. Lohan sits on the end of a bed in his boxer shorts and vest, and puts on his socks. He stands up, slightly pot-bellied and with greying hair, shakes out a pale striped shirt and puts it on. Downstairs, and wearing a V-neck jumper as well, he sits alone at the table as a woman puts a cooked breakfast of sausage, bacon, egg and toast down in front of him. He takes a sip of his tea and eats the breakfast, dropping crumbs onto the napkin in his lap, which he brushes onto the floor. He comes out of the house and puts his bag on the bonnet of his car, then opens the gates at the end of a short driveway. He steps onto the pavement and looks down the street. First one way at the silent, empty road, save for two parked cars and a green hill rising up beyond it, then the other way, which is completely empty and equally silent and still. He goes back to his car, lies down on the ground, and checks underneath it. The woman who gave him his breakfast pulls the curtains aside to watch as he gets into the car and puts his key in the ignition. She seems unhappy as he drives away. He's now in open countryside.
The dirty protest and the blanket protest, which has been going on for years, all in support of the same demand, political status, that is to say, different treatment for people who commit crimes, hideous crimes, for what they claim to be a political motive, and that is what the government will not grant.
Lohan walks into a white brick corridor with frosted windows. He goes along it with his bag over his shoulder, and through a door at the end into a large and basic changing room. He walks through it, past men with towels around their waists or in varying stages of dress. He opens a locker with a set of keys that have a round Union flag fob on them, puts a gun and his rings on the top shelf and takes out a cap. Prison guards sit round a table together.
About an hour later, there's a bit of fumbling back and coming from the granny's room. So Dal walks up to the granny's room, he opens the door, and there's a wee fella having a go at the granny. And the wee fella turns around and goes, "See, that's so fucking funny when it's your man."
Lohan, now in uniform, has his hands in a sink of water again, eyes closed. As the pain subsides and his breathing eases, he begins to relax. The cuts are rawer and the water tinged pink with blood. Now he's standing outside against a plain white brick wall, wearing black trousers and a blue officer's shirt with the sleeves rolled up. His legs are apart, and he keeps one hand in his pocket while he smokes with the other. He puts his head back to exhale, and snow gently drifts down around him. Resting back against the wall, he stares up at the sky, his mouth slightly open, the hand holding the cigarette suspended near his stomach. He takes another drag from it, tiny snowflakes landing on his hand and melting around the bloody grazes on his knuckles. He puts his head back again and exhales the smoke. He wipes a hand over his face, then looks down at a fat black rat that runs away along the wall and throws his cigarette end at it. He leans back against the wall again, his shirt and hair damp from the snow. He walks down a gloomy corridor lined with closed prison cell doors. As he approaches a metal gate, another guard in full uniform lets him through. Now he's wearing his uniform jacket, sitting alone in the canteen, sipping out of a cup from a flask, while guards around him smoke and chat. He looks down at the tin foil his food was wrapped in and smooths it out slightly with his hands, then starts to fold it up. He folds it into a rough rectangle, tucking away the loose edges, then over again and again until it's a small square. Then he puts it down on the table in front of him, picks up a sandwich, and carries on eating. One of the guards on the table beside him gets up and leaves. An empty toilet, then outside in the snow.
There is no such thing as political murder, political bombing, or political violence. There is only criminal murder, criminal bombing, and criminal violence. We will not compromise on this. There will be no political status.
Inside a van, carrying a young prisoner with brown hair and a moustache, and two officers. Another guard opens the back doors from outside, and they lead the young man into the prison. They wait in front of a gate, while the one behind them's closed, then carry on through. In the governor's office...
I will not wear the uniform of a criminal. I demand to wear my own clothes.
The governor writes the name Davy Gillen in his book, then non-conforming prisoner, and the date, 1st of December 1980. There are numerous similar entries above it. He puts down his pen and looks up at Davy, who stares down at the floor, then briefly round at the other guards in the room, before eventually taking off his wool-lined denim jacket. He holds it in front of him for a moment, then puts it down on the floor. He He looks unhappily at one of the officers again, before taking off his jumper. Davy looks behind him at the officer standing by the door, then puts his jumper down with the coat. As the governor continues to watch him, Davy hesitatingly puts a hand to his shirt button, pauses, then starts to undo them. He turns again to look at the officer by the door, then back at the governor as he untucks his shirt and leaves it hanging open. He takes it off, revealing a pale and skinny but well-defined body, and drops the shirt on the floor. He pulls his jeans down and steps out of them. Then he pulls his pants down and stands naked in front of the governor, who gets up out of his chair and hands a grey blanket to one of the guards. Davy is escorted out of the office, still naked, and given the blanket. Carrying it in front of him, he's escorted along one of the prison corridors, through a number of gates, and past closed cell doors. One guard leads the way, while another keeps hold of Davy's arm, escorting him. The leading guard stops at a cell door, unlocks it and opens it, then they send Davy inside. The guard locks the door and they walk away again. Davy stands in the filthy, small, dark and shadowy cell, slowly looking round it in numb disbelief. The walls around the door are completely covered with feces. A white plastic bin lid is also smeared with feces, as is a cloth on the floor and the rest of the walls. Opposite him is a window, barred and with a wire grill in front of it, offering nothing except pale white light. He looks round at the last wall, also completely covered in feces, then down at the floor, where another prisoner is hunched in the shadows. The long-haired, bearded man looks up at Davy, resting his head against the wall, and staring at him. Davy and his new cellmate are sitting opposite each other, only a few feet apart, blankets round their shoulders.
Joe Maradato.
The man's hair is thick, his face pale and gaunt.
What's this your surname is again?
Gillen.
Gillen. Fancy Quinn. Falls Road, Fancy Quinn. Do you know him?
No.
No?
How long did you get?
12 years. You?
Six years. Aye.
You lucky bastard.
An officer walks down the corridor and adds Davy Gillen's card to Jerry Campbell's outside their cell door. He checks through the peephole, then walks away again. In the cell, Davy places one bare, feces-smeared foot into the gloomy half-light. He's standing at the window, the blanket wrapped around his narrow waist. He slides his hand through a broken part of the metal grill and through the bars, all the way up to his elbow. He rests his forehead against the grill. Then he looks down, slowly, and only half reactive, at a fly that's sitting on a piece of the shorn metal. Davy gently prods it with his finger, but the insect only moves out of his way a little, crawling along the metal. He follows it, prodding it still, and it falls off, dropping a few inches and landing on another part of the grill. Davy puts his hand underneath it, tempting it on, but the fly begins to climb up the grill. He puts his finger in front of it, then beside it, trying to get it to walk on his skin, but it stubbornly resists. It climbs back down again, and he holds his palm out underneath it. This time the fly does step under his hand, but when he holds it up, it falls off almost straight away. Davy looks for a moment at his dirty skin. Then he puts his arm back out through the hole again and looks out into the light. Now he's sitting in the corner by the brown stained walls, eating from a plate, while Jerry smears more feces on the wall opposite him. Davy stands up and throws his food into a rotting pile in the corner. He moulds it together in a sponge-like substance around the doorframe. As if on order, one of them carefully tips a bowl of dark urine under the door so it seeps out into the corridor. All the way along the corridor, urine comes out of every door, trickling towards the centre in elongated puddles until it meets and merges with the pool coming from an opposite door. Jerry's wiping his backside with his hand and rubbing it on the walls. Davy has a small square piece of paper covered in tiny writing, which he folds up and wraps in plastic. He turns it into a little ball and presses it down as much as possible, then puts it in his mouth, holds his lips shut and strains. When it's done, he lies down on his back, with his arm under his head. Davy and Jerry are led out of their cell and through one of the gates, where they're held by guards, while a third officer opens the next one. They're escorted into a wider, open central area, then through another gate. Standing in a white concrete room with concrete bars in the window, they take off their cloths that are wrapped around their waists and pick up some clothes. Jerry struggles to tear a hole in his with his teeth, and they both turn anxiously and wait when they hear a sound outside. Jerry makes the hole bigger with his fingers and puts the trousers on. Decently dressed, they join others in a visiting room, where Davy sits opposite a young woman. Another prisoner takes a tiny baby in his arms and cradles it, then looks up suspiciously. The girl that Jerry's sitting opposite looks around impatiently and slightly sullenly while an officer walks past their table. Once he's gone, Jerry nods, and she reaches down between her legs. Davy kisses his woman and passes her the note that he concealed. Jerry's girl pulls a wrapped, oblong-shaped object out from between her legs and passes it to him under the table. She smiles as she watches him poke it through the hole he made in his trousers and up his bottom. The prisoner with the baby takes something out of its clothing and puts it in his mouth. Back in the cell, Jerry retrieves the white package from the pile of rotten food and maggots on the floor. Davy sits against the filthy wall while Jerry crouches in a patch of auburn light and removes the plastic wrapping. Inside is a small red tube with two long wires in it, which he unravels, and an earpiece on the end. He goes over to the window, balances the tube on the torn bit of grill, and puts the earpiece in. Davy's lying asleep at night with his blanket over him. He slowly opens his eyes, blinking, and stares up at the ceiling. He looks over to the side and sees Jerry's asleep. Both of them are lying on opposite sides of the cell, about 4 feet between them. Davy looks up at the ceiling again. He pulls his arm nearest the wall out from under the blanket, lies still again, then rests his hand on his chest. He looks over at Jerry, who's still asleep, then lifts up his head and unfolds a piece of paper into a small square. Holding it in his left hand, he puts his right hand under the blanket and slowly starts masturbating. He glances over at Jerry to make sure he hasn't woken, then back at the bit of paper. Jerry stirs and rolls onto his back, and Davy immediately stops, hiding the bit of paper and lying still. After a moment he glances over at Jerry, then looks at the piece of paper again, and carries on masturbating. Daytime, and Jerry's sitting up against the wall. He moves, listening. He looks over at Davy by the window. Jerry frowns. Two prison guards walk down the corridor, removing the name cards from their holders on the wall. Jerry looks briefly at Davy, then he rises up. They both watch the door nervously.
Be Rhaenish.
What?
Get ready.
Jerry stands in the centre of the cell, facing the door, and Davy goes to stand beside him. Fearful, they both tighten the blankets that are wrapped around their waists. Another prisoner is pulled out of his cell by two guards wearing yellow rubber gloves and slammed against the corridor wall. Davy and Jerry stand tense and afraid. The prisoner's dragged along the polished floor by his arms. He manages to scramble to his feet and kicks one of the guards, but they beat him down again and force him through another gate. The prisoner, who has long, wild hair, grabs hold of a bar, but they peel his fingers away and drag him into a wide open area, then stand him up to face the governor. Then they take him to Lohan, who's waiting in the toilets. Lohan punches him once, then the prisoner ducks and he hits the wall. The prisoner's dragged into the toilets, where his head's forced down onto a low stool. Stressed, Lohan splashes water over his face, then grabs a large pair of scissors and starts savagely cutting the prisoner's long, dirty hair and beard. As he works viciously, blood covers his and the guard's hands, along with the prisoner's face. When he's done, they carry the now naked prisoner over to a bath and throw him in, aggressively washing him with their gloved hands and forcing his bloody head under. Lohan picks up a broom and violently scrubs him with it. Then they drag him out, docile now, and back to his cell. Lohan fills a sink with clean water and gingerly places his bloody hands into it, wincing with pain. The pink bathwater laps gently against the sides as the prisoner, with his roughly shorn hair and beard, is carried face down back to his cell. Lohan stands outside against the white brick wall, one hand in his pocket, the other lifting a cigarette to his mouth, his legs slightly apart, as snow drifts down around him. Inside, a man wearing a full green protective suit with full headgear and mask and long black rubber gloves walks down the prison corridor, which has a hose snaking along it. He picks up a long, thin metal nozzle that's attached to the hose and goes into one of the feces-covered cells. He stops in surprise and lifts up his mask for a clearer look. On one wall, a perfect, almost artistic spiral has been smeared in the feces. Starting in the very centre of the spiral, the cleaner slowly starts to wash it off with the high-powered jet, creating a small circle of white and working outwards from it. As he sprays the jet of water, a fine mist dances around him. On the wall, brown liquid runs down as the surface muck washes away, while some of the more ingrained stains stubbornly remain. The prisoner, who was savagely washed, is sitting in the visitor's room, his face cut and bruised, hair crudely shorn. He looks away, smoking, then turns to face an elderly couple who are looking at him in shock.
Are you all right, Bobby?
I'm Grandma.
Are they giving you treatment for that?
It's being looked after. And the old fella?
He's a handful, I'll tell you that.
Are you eating all right?
I'm grand, Ma.
Are they feeding you all right?
Don't you be worrying about me.
5 minutes. Davy's visitor blows something out of his nose and slides it across the table to him.
You eating all right?
Aye.
Tastes like shit, though, doesn't it?
You get used to it.
Bobby watches them, then looks at the woman who's holding his hand.
You're looking well.
So are you, son. So are you.
A prison service. They ignore the priest.
The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit.
Bobby Sands listens as people talk to him.
But the Lord delivers them from them all. He protects all his bones, and not one of them will be broken.
Only Davy listens to the priest.
Evil will slay the wicked. The foes of the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems his servants. No one will be condemned who finds refuge.
Davy passes Bobby something on his way out, which he puts in his mouth. Bobby shakes all the inmates' hands as they leave.
Let us pray.
Bobby sits alone in his dark, shadowy cell. Using the small amount of warm auburn light available to him, he slowly unfolds a small square of paper covered in writing and puts it down in front of him. He carefully tears a page out of a book that's lying beside him, pausing whenever he hears a sound, then rolls the paper up in his fingers. He licks one edge, rolls it into a cigarette, which he puts in his mouth, then strikes a light. When he gets a flame, he lights the cigarette. Bobby takes it from his mouth and inhales. He picks up the square of paper that he'd previously unfolded and reads it. When he's finished, and with a cigarette in his mouth, he puts one corner of the paper against the glowing ember and sucks until the note catches light and starts to smoulder. He puts the paper down and holds his hands around it for a moment, shielding it, then looks up thoughtfully, sitting cross-legged with his arms resting on his knees, as the flame briefly flares. Bobby's standing in his dark cell, looking out of the barred and grilled window, silhouetted by the white light beyond it. What little light does enter reflects off his face. He looks down and bends to pick something up off the floor. It's the remains of the note he burnt, just a charred scrap with scorched edges, but some of the writing is still there, most prominently the underlined word, negotiate. He holds the scrap of paper between thumb and finger for a moment, then scrunches it in his palm and looks up into the light again. His eyes, one of them still bruised, stare at the floor, then progressively upwards as if considering an idea. Bobby's standing in a clean cell in normal light, facing the door, when a guard opens it and steps out to where more guards and prisoners line the corridor. One prisoner is sent through a gate to where an officer hands him brightly coloured clothes in oranges, reds, yellows and greens. The gate opens again, and the next prisoner, wearing just the dirty white cloth round his waist, goes in to collect his clothes. Bobby watches, quietly incensed, as he files back past him. The prisoners are back in their clean cells, the bright, colourful clothes laid out on their beds. Davy and Jerry stand facing opposite directions, their heads bowed. Bobby sits on the edge of his bed, his foot tapping agitatedly on the floor. Then he stops suddenly and picks up a table. As he wrecks his cell, Baby, Jerry and the other prisoners react and start wrecking theirs as well. They break furniture, tear the clothes, turn their beds over and attack the grills over the windows. The corridors are empty. An officer wearing a black helmet sits nervously in the back of a van, looking round at his colleagues who are dressed in full riot gear. The back doors open and they run into the prison, where one of them hands out plastic shields. They join other officers who are already standing against a wall in the central area, forming two lines. A prison officer in a blue shirt puts a block down on the floor with a mirror on it, spits on it and polishes it. The warden walks in.
Everything in order?
Yes, sir, in order, sir.
Very good.
The three prison officers watch him leave. In the corridor, a guard unlocks the gates and opens them both up. Then he walks along, removing the name cards from their holders on the wall next to all the cell doors. Lohan waits, sucking on his thumb. He looks at the blood around the nail, then stares straight ahead, waiting, with a brief glance down the corridor. The mirror on the block has been polished, and one of the officers puts on some yellow rubber gloves. The young riot guard from the van waits nervously. The guard in the corridor collects the last name card and makes his way back, leaving it silent and empty. The riot guards and officers wait in the central area as a worker pushes a tea trolley past. The young officer turns to his colleague, then they all start hitting their shields with their batons. They run into the corridor and take up positions on either side of the wall. The young riot guard looks scared but psyched. Jerry's thrown out of his cell by two guards. They slam him against the wall and two more drag Davy out. He's thrown naked into the tunnel of riot guards, who beat him with their batons. Jerry's beaten up as Davy crawls through trying to protect himself. When he reaches the end, two prison officers force him up against a wall. Then they slam him up against a gate facing the central area where another prisoner is beaten. The young riot guard stands nervously. Davy is dragged across the floor to the officers and the mirror and is hit again. He's made to squat over the mirror, and the officer performs a vicious anal search with his finger. They stand Davy up. Then the same officer roughly pulls his mouth open and searches around his gums. They drag him away, and the next one's brought through. He's also made to squat. After the anal search, the prisoner headbutts him.
What fucking name is this?
riot guard steps in and beats him repeatedly. Bobby's taken back to his prison cell and dropped face down on the floor. The young riot guard stands behind a wall in the corridor, shaking, tearful, and afraid. On the other side, another prisoner struggles through the gauntlet of riot guards, who mercilessly beat his naked body. In his cell, Bobby Sands slowly rolls over onto his back, blood smeared over his face from his nose and mouth, an almost delirious smile in his eyes. He swallows deeply and stares vacantly upwards. Lohan's sitting in his car on a terraced street. Beneath a covering of white cloud, he opens his door and gets out. He reaches back into the car and lifts out a bouquet of pink flowers. Cradling them in one arm, he walks around the side of a building. He goes into the main room of an old people's home, where a woman sits in the centre of the room, staring straight ahead.
Hey, Mum.
She doesn't move or acknowledge him, and he sits down in the chair beside her.
What are you doing sitting in here?
With her head resting on the back of the chair, she continues to stare blankly ahead. Lohan looks briefly in the direction of her gaze, then back at her. He holds the flowers out and moves as if to show them to her, but instead puts them down on the small round table in front of them.
Daisies.
A man walks in behind him and shoots him in the back of the head, then calmly walks out again. Lohan slumps into his mother's lap, blood sprayed over her face and chest. She moves her head slightly to one side. A priest and a prison guard walk down a dark corridor, moving between the rays of light that shine in through barred windows in the wall until they reach the end. The guard opens the door and lets the priest through first. Wearing trousers but no top, Bobby's sitting at a table in the empty visiting room. He looks up.
You can sit down any time you like.
Priest etiquette. Never sit before you're asked.
Sit down then.
Don't come over too eager.
Look, best to hover at the door.
You learned that your first week in the seminary, Bobby.
He sits down opposite Bobby.
Sake.
Come on.
Bit of a break from smoking the Bible, eh?
Why?
Anyone work out which Bic is the best smoke?
We only smoke the Lamentations. Right, miserable cigarette?
Nice room. Very clean.
Where is it you're from again, Tom?
Bourne, you mean?
Bally go backwards.
Oh, the city dog.
Bally Roberts.
Oh, we play south of Bally Money. Kilray.
I remember a homily you did at Mass one time.
Oh, will you listen to it?
Sure, the men hold you in very high esteem.
I can feel a dig coming on.
You're very quick.
Right.
Now, you're respected, you know that. But I like those stories you tell about the countryside.
A childhood of poaching, robbing apples, stampeding cattle.
Fine education for a priest.
Priest working in West Belfast, that is, yeah.
Stampeding comes in handy down the Falls Road.
Or you see hate me.
You miss it, though.
What?
Countryside.
I should get home to see my wee brother every month or so, but... I miss the usual. Clean air, space, all that.
Feels closer to who you are.
Aye, well, it is. No question. Something like a fish out of water working in a big city like Belfast, but it's a job, isn't it? You stop looking around at your surroundings quick enough when you figure your business is the business of the soul and all.
Business of the soul?
Ah, you know what I mean.
Learned that in the seminary too?
Aye, and you can use that free of charge.
Go on.
Well, I suppose what I'm saying is, you get on. Kilray can wait till I'm an old man.
Too many scoundrels to be saved in Belfast anyway.
Busy work, aye.
Shall God reward you in heaven?
And I'll be thankful, once there's wine involved.
What's your wee brother do back home?
He's a parish priest. He's a sneaky wee bastard. You know the sort, Bobby.
Still goes poaching?
Poaching jobs. And he's younger than me by 8 years, all right.
Go on.
As a cleric, I work in a parish beside Kilray, wee hole of a place. I'm working me arse off. House calls to the elderly, mobile confessions.
The glamour stuff.
Oh, aye. So, anyway, position comes up at Kilray.
Right.
And I'm passed over for some reason or other. No reason, probably.
Taking too much cake off the old ladies.
Probably.
So?
So about 5 years later, position again comes up back home at Kilray. And my brother Michael waltzes right into it.
Fuck.
He's made parish priest at 28.
More spiritual, probably. Less lippy than you.
Mm-hmm. You work the bishop. He's a golfer. He's a pushy little twerp, is what he is.
At least you're not bitter.
Oh, no, I couldn't be that, no.
Parish priest at 28? Fantastic.
Hmm. He's two cars. And the house he has is massive. He's a maid, a cook. I'm stuck in a two up, two down, with a fat Kerry man who drones on and on about Gaelic football. Can we stop talking about this?
Jesus, you're the one who's talking.
Hmm. How's your smoke going?
Grand.
Hmm. Filthy habit. Disgusting.
Oh, aye, awful. Lovely, though.
Aye, praise the Lord.
28. My God.
Oh, stop it. So what happened to your eye, Bobby?
What?
You gotta dig for yourself, your eye.
Difference of opinion.
Hmm. How's the other fella?
Oh, that's worse. Believe me.
So, what did you call me here for?
Well, is that the idle banter over what?
Priest etiquette. Start with a small talk.
I'm learning a lot about the priesthood, Don.
Hmm, you'd make a fine priest.
Why?
Good talker, man of principle, leader of men.
Political terrorist.
The church loves a reformed crook.
Aye. I always felt that thief next to Jesus got off lightly.
Ah, but he recognised his sins.
Did he, though?
Aye, said as much.
If you're hung from a cross, you're going to say anything. Jesus offers him a seat next to his daddy in a place called Paradise. You're always going to put your hand up and have a piece of that?
Aye, even when it's nailed to your cross.
Jesus Christ, that's sacrilegious.
Sacrilegious?
Aye.
No, 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 he was a dirty thief. So, what do you want to tell me? Where are you at? Been driven mad by that governor yet?
See this negotiating work? It's been a sideshow. I'll tell you that for nothing.
But you understand why you need to do it?
Because we're no longer good propaganda.
According to who? The leadership?
Time has come. Decision had to be made.
You think that's what the leadership think?
Maybe, I don't know.
Bit paranoid there, Bobby.
10,000 people marched for the 7 hunger strikers last October, right?
Right.
International pressure on the Brits and all that.
Busy time.
Even the Pope's having a say, getting involved. The whole world trying to get Maggie Thatcher to back down and give us our demands, but it all came to nothing.
Right.
Hunger strike failed. We're on the front line. We created the protest. It's our responsibility. Leadership have been very clear to me, Dom. 4.5 years of the no-wash protest, as much as it's highlighted republicanism to some extent, it's also distracted from the wider development of the organisation.
That's because your needs are specific needs.
Of course they are. Some woman bringing up 3 children in West Belfast shouldn't care about civilian-type clothing or whatever the fuck they're calling these clown outfits.
That's so.
Honest to God, Dom. We were promised our own clothes. It's childish skullduggery.
So the leadership have had enough of you?
In the ideal world, we'd be fighting our battles independently, but we're tied. Nothing's changed in here. Nothing's moved on. The leadership are stuck with us until there's some realistic chance of movement towards political status. That's the hard truth of it.
See, to get me to negotiate with these lying, reneging monkeys when there's never nothing on the table, it's just pure crap. I'm not going to be marched into this governor's office and get caught up in some mindless, pointless dialogue with that pompous bastard.
He's a big fan of yours.
Thick as two short planks, Dom. A moron. Can you believe they made him governor, though? It's a bloody insult to humanity.
Mother of Jesus, where do you get your energy from?
As a cross-country runner, as a boy.
I could have guessed it. Big engine on you. Cross-country running. Explains a lot about you, Bobby.
Well, I loved it so, Ed. That's the whole country thing for me. Jesus, they'd have to hold me back at the finishing line or keep on running. Little scraps here are mongrels from out of the city. Frightened of cattle and all. It was a funny time.
Frightened of cattle?
Oh, I terrified of them. Think you could get milk and burgers from them monsters? Jesus Christ. And next time round, I'll be born in the countryside, guaranteed. Wildlife, birds. And of all that, paradise.
Aye. And you could learn to relax, too.
Aye. Maybe, never know. Never tried it before. I'm starting a hunger strike on the 1st of March. That's why you're here. That's what I'm telling you.
Aye, I heard that. Does your family know?
I got word out, didn't I?
Have you spoken with them?
Got a visit in 2 weeks' time. We'll talk then.
How do you think they'll take it?
What do you think, Tom?
And your wee boy.
Bobby helps himself to another cigarette.
So, what makes it different from the last time?
Last time our strike was flawed. It became emotional. 7 men started at the same time. They all got weak and they couldn't let the weakest one die, which left us susceptible to being conned by the Brits, and that's exactly what we were, conned. This time out, the men will start consecutively 2 weeks apart. Somebody dies, they'll be replaced. There's no shortage of us. 75 men have put their names forward.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
The announcement's being made today.
So what makes this protest different is that you're set to die, Bobby.
May well come to that.
You start a hunger strike to protest for what you believe in. You don't start already determined to die, or am I missing something here?
It's in their hands. Our message is clear. They're seeing our determination.
So it'll take a couple of deaths, do you think? Maybe 5 or 6? Which other 75 of you?
Aye, well, it won't come to that.
All right, maybe the Brits will buckle after 20 or so. But why should you care? Because you're already dead, right? Have you thought about what you're going to be putting these boys through? I mean, putting aside what's going to happen to these poor men's families, you're going head-to-head with a British government who clearly despise republicanism, who are unshakable. They can easily live with the deaths of what they call terrorists. And the stakes are much higher this time.
I know that.
And if you're not even willing to negotiate, you're looking for them to capitulate. Is that it?
Right.
So failure means many dead men, families torn apart, and the whole Republican movement demoralised.
Aye. Worst case scenario, it might well mean all that. But short term, out of the ashes, guaranteed there'll be a new generation of men and women. Even more resilient, more determined.
Look who you're talking to.
There's a war going on. I thought you might understand. You're talking like a foreigner.
You're talking to me like I'm a foreigner. You think I don't know Northern Ireland? I live here, man.
Then support us.
I supported the first hunger strike on the basis it was a protest. Not some pre-designed to die and balk at negotiation other than complete surrender from Thatcher. That's ridiculous, Bobby. It's destructive.
What's happening here for the last 4 years? The brutality, humiliation, our basic human rights taken away from us. All of this has to come to an end.
Through talking.
So what? We take their offer and put their uniform on, because the last 4 years have meant nothing. We could do that, Don. Or we could behave like the army we proclaim to be and lay down our lives for our comrades.
Is there not even a small part of you that's hoping for a breakthrough that could find you negotiating again?
That won't happen.
Right, forget about that. I want to know whether your intent is just purely to commit suicide here.
You want me to argue about the morality of what I'm about to do and whether it's really suicide or not? For one, you're calling it suicide. I call it murder. And that's just another wee difference between us two. We're both Catholic men, both Republicans. But while you were poaching salmon and lovely Kilray, we were being burnt out of our house in Rathcoole.
Right.
Similar in many ways, Dom, but life and experience has focused our beliefs differently, you understand me?
I understand.
I have my belief, and in all its simplicity, that is the most powerful thing.
So what's your statement about dying? Just highlighting British intransigence, so fucking what? The whole world knows what the Brits are like.
Good.
Aye, it is good, and it's nothing to do with you. The Brits have been fucking up everything for centuries.
I can feel your hatred, Dom.
Oh, you looking for martyrdom?
No.
Are you sure?
Aye.
Because I've heard you eulogising Wolfe Tone, Connolly, McSwinney, all them men. Can't help thinking you're writing your name large for all them history books.
Because you think that matters to me.
Oh, aye, I know it does.
Well, you're wrong.
You see, you soldiers, it's all about the freedom. But you got no appreciation of a life, Bobby. You no longer know what a life is, you man. 4 years living in these conditions, no one expects you to be normal. There's nothing normal about you. Right now, the Republican movement has talked itself into a corner. You IRA are standing right behind it looking into that corner. All that history, all them dead men and women, you're still seeing nothing. When your answer is to kill everything, you've blinded yourself and you're scared to stop it. Afraid of living. Afraid of talk and peace. So what would Ulster be if it wasn't turning itself to shit? And this situation here, that the future of the Republican movement is in the hands of you men who have lost all sense of reality. You think your head's on right? Locked up in here 24 hours a day and pissing shit. And you are making decisions that I could see so many men die. Build a statue to Bobby Sands. You're joking me. Freedom fighter. They're the men and women working out there in the community. And that was you once upon a time, am I right? All that work you did in Twinbrook. That's where we need you, Bobby, and you know I'm right.
But I'm deluded. You want me to answer that?
They're beating you, Bobby. You're playing into their hands.
The strategy's in place.
Then stop it. Just say stop.
You don't understand a thing.
You're in no shape to make this call.
It's done. It won't be stopped.
Then fuck it. Life must mean nothing to you.
God's gonna punish me.
Well, if not just for the suicide, then he'd have to punish you for stupidity.
Aye. And you for your arrogance. Because my life is a real life, not some theological exercise, some religious trick that's got fuck all to do with living. Jesus Christ had a backbone. But see then, disciples, every disciple since, you're just jumping in and out of the rhetoric and dead-end semantics. You need the revolutionary. You need the cultural political soldier to give life a pulse, to give life a direction.
That's stupid talk, you're deluded.
Aye. So you say.
Yeah, and what's your wee son gonna say? Fuck off. Doesn't that interest you?
You're gonna attack me with sentiment. Typical priest.
What's your heart saying, Bobby?
I thought you'd be all figured out, Dom.
What's it saying? Tell me.
My life means everything to me. Freedom means everything. I know you don't mean to mock me, Dom, so I'll just let all that pass. This is one of these times when we've come to a pause. It's a time to keep your beliefs pure. I believe that a united Ireland is right and just. Maybe it's impossible for a man like you to understand. But having a respect for my life, a desire for freedom, an unyielding love for that belief, means I can see past any doubts I may have. Putting my life on the line is not just the only thing I can do, Dom. It's the right thing.
This is why you called me here. Need a sounding board. Not 100% sure of yourself. Been doubting yourself, maybe.
Aye. Well, I'm a human.
And I've made it clear for you then.
Man of guidance, Dom. Business of the soul.
The two men stare at each other across the table. Then Bobby takes another cigarette.
You've been to Gweedore and Donegal.
Aye.
went there when I was 12. Big cross-country race for the boys. And we're all in the back of a minibus headed towards Derry one morning. I mean, this is big time. Now, this is like international athletics for us because we're racing against boys in the south. And we have this thing to do Belfast Pride. Two of the boys are prods. The rest of us are Catholics. It's a cross-community event. I suppose the good people in the south think this is great stuff. And let's get this wee team over from Belfast and all that patronising shite. Through the border. The boys are all singing pop tunes and all. But I'm just on the back of the bus looking out the window. We're going through them mountains. You know where Mount Errigal is and everything? It's a beautiful sight, Dom. Donegal has to be the most beautiful place in Ireland, I reckon. Arrive at Gweedore. What a place, and it's popping with about 200 boys in there, getting into their gear and limbering up. The whole event's run by Christian Brothers, and they're clipping young fellas around the back of the ears, basically trying to retain some order. Our team goes off for a wee jog, stretch out the legs. We're surrounded by fields of barley. And they dip down into a wee valley where there's a stream and woods running through it. Woods and the stream are out of bounds, so naturally us Belfast boys have to go check them out. Woods and the stream, though, I'm sure that's like the Amazon to us. And we come across these young fellas from Cork. There's some banter about our accents, but they could barely talk. We couldn't understand what they were saying. You get the idea that they're lording it over us a bit, you know? Looking down on us, I'm sensing it anyway. We're running along, and we come up with this idea to go down to the stream and check it out for fish. So we're down by the river Dome stream. There's half a foot of water in there. Little silver fish, but none substantial. Till one of their boys calls us further down. Lying in the water is a wee fool. 4 or 5 days old. He's all skin and bone, a grey colour, and he's got flecks of blood in his coat because he's cut himself up really badly on the sharp rocks. We're just standing over him and you can see his back leg snapped. And he's breathing. He's alive, but just about. So this big conversation gets started up between the boys who suddenly reckon themselves the leaders. They're deliberating as what we should do. Someone says drop a rock in his head, but I'm looking in their faces and I can see they're either scared stiff or clueless. It's all bravado. And this fool on the ground, in real pain. All this chit-chat going nowhere. Next thing, one of the priests sees the fool, tells us not to move and we're done for. I mean, we're really done for. Group of boys will always get the blame for hurting the fool. Group of Belfast boys will get a hammering for sure. So it's clear to me in an instant, and I'm down on my knees, and I take the fool's head in my hands and I put him underwater. He's thrashing around a bit to start, so I press down harder until he's drowned. Priest arrives, though. He's grabbing me by the hair, dragging me through the woods, promising me a proper hiding. But I knew I did the right thing by that wee fool. And I could take the punishment for all our boys. I had the respect of them other boys now, and I knew that. I'm clear of the reasons, Dom. I'm clear of all the repercussions. But I will act, and I will not stand by and do nothing.
Bobby stares defiantly at the priest, thin wisps of smoke rising up in front of him. The priest stares back, his expression hard and thoughtful. He softens a little and turns his head to one side, looking down at the floor, then at Bobby again. He opens his mouth to speak, but changes his mind. Then he comes out of his reverie and picks up his cigarettes.
You can leave them there if you like. Don't be rolling up the letters to St. John, do you?
Couldn't have that on my conscience, no.
He looks down at the table, then at Bobby.
I don't think I'm going to see you again, Bobby.
There's no need, Tom.
Bobby drags on his cigarette, then blows the smoke out through his nostrils, like steam from a bull. He looks up. He looks down at the foil ashtray and squashes the cigarette out in it. The corridor is again filled with converging pools of urine that the prisoners have poured under their doors. A man walks down it, wearing dark blue overalls, black gloves and Wellington boots, sloshing blue liquid over the black floor. When he reaches the end, he turns and goes all the way back to the start of the corridor by the large metal gates. He puts the bottle of cleaner down, picks up a brush with a solid plastic edge, and starts pushing the liquid down the corridor. He moves from side to side at a steady pace, the volume of liquid that is sloshing about growing deeper all the time. The strip lights above are reflected in the still pools of urine and cleaning fluid that is yet to reach. About halfway down, he turns and pushes some of the urine under one of the cell doors. Then he carries on again. Once he gets near to the end of the corridor, he does the same again, pushing the liquid under one of the doors, but this time on the opposite side. By the time he reaches the end, he's shepherding a large pool of liquid. Slowly moving back over the small puddles and streaks that remain all along the floor.
Faced now with the failure of their discredited cause, the men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what may well be their last card. They've turned their violence against themselves through the prison hunger strike to death. They seek to work on the most basic of human emotions, pity, as a means of creating tension and stoking the fires of bitterness and hatred.
A man lies in bed beneath clean white sheets in a plain white prison room, his head resting on two pillows, a wooden table with a jug of water beside him. A small, single white feather flutters down and floats briefly on the air before sinking out of view. With Bobby's parents,
And from week one, there's been a gradual deterioration of liver, kidney and pancreatic function. Also, the bone density decreases substantially due to calcium and vitamin deficiencies. The muscle of the heart is also undernourished, causing impaired function and eventually cardiac failure.
A needle goes into Bobby's vein to take blood.
The left ventricle could shrink to 70% of its normal size. He will have low blood sugar, low energy and muscular wasting.
He pees.
He'll be experiencing gastrointestinal ulcers with the thinning of the intestinal wall and submucosal hemorrhaging. There will have been degenerative changes to the mucous membrane of the intestines and indeed all the organs in the body.
With sores covering his back and the underside of his arms, Bobby steps down off the scales in the doctor's room, his pale torso narrow, sinewy and taut. He slowly puts on his pyjama top, the wafer-like skin stretching even tighter across his chest and ribs as he extends an arm to put into the sleeve. Looking down a clear, lighter corridor with a pale floor, one of the cell doors is open and Bobby sitting on the edge of his bed in the white hospital room when a porter walks in. Bobby takes his pajama top off, revealing large red sores on his back. When the porter applies some ointment to one, Bobby flinches at the touch. The moist, fleshy sores are on his shoulder blades, his spine, and the base of his back, the skin around them brownish red. While Bobby lies in his bed, someone takes away a tray of scrambled eggs on toast and brings back some fried food with a steaming cup of hot drink. That tray is taken away and another brought in its place. Then a plate of toast and jam with an apple, all of which Bobby ignores. Bobby's sitting on the toilet when the porter walks in. He tries to stand up but falls, and as the porter catches him, he notices the bowl is full of spattered blood. Bobby retches in bed. Every muscle and sinew strains in his body with the effort. A flock of birds rises up from the branches of a winter tree. Bobby's entire torso heaves deeply with the labour of breathing as he recovers. His sheets are stained with the rust-coloured spots of dried blood and pus. The blackbirds flap around the tree again. Bobby, anguished and in pain, lies with his head turned to one side, the sheets pulled down to his waist, both arms lying above them, every lump and line of his body showing through his skin. The stained sheets are pulled off the empty bed, and the plastic mattress beneath, which is also stained, is half-heartedly and ineffectively wiped, then turned over. New, clean sheets are put on, then a thick, white fur rug placed on top of them. Bobby sits on a chair in the corridor, looking at and feeling the sharp base of his protruding ribcage, his stomach below it further concaved by several inches. Two porters come out and gently help him on with his pajama top, putting one arm in the sleeve, then the other. Bobby, emaciated and white, can barely move on his own. Between them, they help him back into the room and lower him down onto the bed. Bobby lies still, unmoving and unseeing, his arms by his side. Stretched out, his abdomen curves in from his hips and rises sharply up again to his ribcage. He stares up at the ceiling. The room is now in the gloom of evening, a small patch of pale yellow light falling over his shoulder and parts of his hallowed face. Bobby's head rests on the pillow, so that he stares upwards, his eyes half rolled up into their sockets, his cheeks hollow, with a thin growth of stubble and dark rings under his eyes. At the end of the bed stands a young teenage boy, with dark hair that covers his ears and the back of his neck. He stares silently down at Bobby, with an expressionless and unmoving face, his mouth set in a straight line, his eyes watching, occasionally blinking. Bobby looks back at him, his mouth hanging half open, his blinking slow and pained. When a strip light comes on above the bed, Bobby squeezes his eyes hard, then opens them. A man sitting beside him, talking to him. The man wears civilian clothes. He has thick black hair, a thick black beard, and looks normal and healthy compared with Bobby's gaunt, ashen, frail body and lifeless grey eyes. Bobby watches him and opens his dry, cracked lips to speak, but can manage nothing more. Now Bobby lies in a bath, with a porter sitting on a chair across the room and behind him. A second porter comes in, and the first one looks up at him, frowns, then stands and walks out. The second porter picks up the chair and takes it over to the bath. Turning it round, he sits astride it, facing Bobby, who turns to look at him. The porter has clamped his fist over the back of the chair, exhibiting the letters UDA tattooed across his fingers. Bobby turns away, letting his head drop to one side exhaustedly. The first porter is let through a gate, where one of the officers searches his body and mouth. The second porter watches Bobby as he shakily and weakly stands up in the bath, holding onto the wall for support. Staring back, Bobby defiantly lets go and stands to attention on his own until he faints. He lies on the floor in a tiny, skinny pile of fleshless limbs. The large porter carries him, still unconscious, out of the bathroom, covered in a towel, and seemingly weightless in his arms. Bobby's lying back in his bed with his eyes closed, one hand resting above the sheets, his head and shoulders in a patch of low, golden light, and the rest of the room in shadow. The young teenage lad with the long black hair is standing by the barred window, watching him. He walks slowly towards the bed and puts his hand hesitantly over Bobby's. Bobby opens his eyes and looks at him without moving his head. His expression changes in the minutest detail, showing the slightest hint of a smile. Now Bobby's lying on a doctor's treatment table, having his blood pressure taken. Then the doctor uses a stethoscope and bends down to listen more closely. Back in his own bed, Bobby lies naked on the sheets, his ribs, hips and knees sticking up prominently from his tiny, frail form. The first porter comes in with an arched white metal cage, which he very carefully and very gently places over Bobby's body, stretching from his ankles up to his chest. The porter then lifts the sheets and tenderly lays them over the cage, so that Bobby's body is covered, but there's no weight on him and nothing touching the skin. At the front desk, a prison guard goes to the door, looks through the peephole, then opens it, letting Bobby's parents in. He goes back to his desk and sits down.
Liam.
Roslyn sounds.
Liam.
John sounds.
He writes the names in a book, then shows them into a clean white prison room with two single beds in it. John and Rosaline walk in and stand by one of the beds. John puts a small suitcase on it, then briefly squeezes Rosaline's hand in reassurance. She walks out, and he opens the suitcase, which has some folded clothes in it. He puts one item under the pillow of one bed, and another item under the pillow of another bed. Rosaline's sitting with Bobby. She stands up and kisses him on the forehead. Bobby lies oblivious with his eyes shut, mouth slightly open, lips dried and white, the slight growth of a red beard on his pale skin. His eyelid trembles and twitches. It opens briefly, and the grey pupil rolls upwards and falteringly from side to side as he tries to control it. Struggling to keep the eye open, he turns his head and looks over towards the door, then down, out of focus, at his mother. His vision distorted, he watches her, but she's looking away with her eyes closed. Bobby holds his gaze on her for a long time. Slowly, the image of long golden grass swaying in a gentle breeze, a small group of children running beyond it, and a line of thick green trees behind them. The boys wearing white vests and black shorts run in a group. Then, in a minibus, the boy that was watching Bobby sits with his head leaning against the window.
Bobby!
He looks round, then back out of the window again, smiling. He looks down thoughtfully, watching the road pass by as the sunlight deepens to a rich golden glow, changing the colour of everything it touches. It flares and shines briefly through the window behind him. A boy runs along a wooded path beside a river, his feet pounding the muddy ground, which rises and falls in front of him. It's the young Bobby Sands, looking tired but pushing on. Birds settle in the bare branches of a winter tree. Bobby's path leads him away from the river and into the woods. He stops, looking straight ahead, and catches his breath. Lying in his prison bed, Bobby exhales. His eyes are open, but unseeing, his face ashen, his lips dark. In the forest, the child turns and looks back in the direction he came from, at the golden sunlight beyond the trees. In prison, Bobby's mother puts a hand on his forehead, and he responds slightly, a single tear falling from his eye. In the wood, Bobby swallows nervously, then turns and runs onwards into the darkness of the trees. Bobby's face becomes still, and beneath the midnight blue sky, the birds in the winter tree take flight. Someone covers Bobby's face with a sheet. A gate in the corridor is opened, and he's wheeled through on a stretcher, covered up. They go along a narrow passageway in the office area of the prison, towards some double doors at the end. Bobby is wheeled outside into the night. A vehicle's parked there, and figures move around in front of it. Then his body is lifted up and put inside. Two officers get in and sit either side of it. Once the van doors are shut, the guard comes back in and closes the prison doors. Bobby Sands died after 66 days on hunger strike. During this time, he was elected to the British Parliament as MP for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. After 7 months, the strike was called off. A further 9 men had died. 16 prison officers were killed by paramilitaries during the blanket and no-wash protests. In the following days and months, the British government effectively granted all the prisoners' demands, but without any formal recognition of political status.